Remember how in our last lesson, two great sorrows had overtaken the patriarch Jacob. You'll remember that his beloved Rachel had died. And you will recall that just shortly before that, Deborah, that was Rebekah's nurse, had died. Rebekah's nurse, Deborah, was the only tie that linked them back with a generation that had gone before, with all that was past and beautiful in his life. Here she was buried. And I think of all very nice sorrows. That's what Jacob had to do. For surely there wasn't anyone there that could appreciate as much as he did the fellowship which he had enjoyed with those that had now been laid away to rest. Israel dwelt in that land. Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. This is very sad indeed, dear friends, because he had come now into the land which is identified as the land of the Tower of the Flock. And it is probable that Jacob had gone out into the fields to look over the flocks. This would leave his oldest son, Reuben, more or less in charge of the household. And probably because of this, he took unto himself the liberties, or shall I say license, which did not belong to him. There's something about the Hebrew text that isn't reflected in our English version. It's very, very beautiful, but very sad. This text that we have just read to you, the 22nd verse, says, "And Israel heard of it." And here, there's a break in the continuity of the sentence. And the Masoretic text indicates that there is an hiatus here, a gap. Something seems to have been left out. But evidently it was merely intended to reflect the unspeakable sorrow that had been visited upon Jacob. It doesn't say what Jacob said to his firstborn. That is left entirely out. But there's one thing about it, and the lesson for you and me lies in this, that the things that we do, be they ever so insignificant at the beginning, gradually they grow on us, and they leave the imprint which we call character. We never rise above the level of the things that we think and the things that we do. If we think of high and noble things, if we think of those things which concern God and His kingdom, seeing those things which are above, we will be proportionately noble. But if we think of the things that are low and earthly and fleshly, we will find ourselves gradually drifting in the direction of our thoughts, because in the final analysis, it is as a man thinketh in his heart, not in his head. But as he thinketh in his heart, so is he. And the heart is the seat of our affections. So when I say the things that we think about, I do not mean merely the process of ratiocination or the process of reasoning that we employ, but we do have reference to those things which come from our heart. Now, if we dwell on things that are fleshly, as we've already indicated, we're going to find we're going to develop a character that is fleshly in its nature, earthly. But if we dwell on the things which are above, it says, if ye then be risen with Christ, that means there was a burial of the old man. If ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, and set your affections on the things above. Seek ye first or chiefly the kingdom of God and its righteousness, and all things else will be added unto you. Now note, dear friends, that in this family of Jacob, there were four mothers. There were four different groups of children. And we find Reuben was the oldest. Simeon was the second oldest. Levi was the third oldest. And so far, what have you seen of the character which they developed? Was there anything that reflected Jacob? Far from it. They reflected something that was far lower in its nature and its order than was in the heart and mind of Jacob. And the reason I bring this to your attention is, dear friends, that Jacob loved all of his children. But if you want to see the effect that what his children did had upon him, it isn't what he did immediately, but when the time came for blessing his children, then Jacob's own feelings in the matter are reflected. Now you will remember that Simeon and Levi had massacred very cruelly the Shechemites. But that was not what had been in the heart of Jacob. Even though his only daughter, Dinah, had been humbled, that wasn't in his mind. But you'll find as you read the 49th chapter of the book of Genesis, how that Lord, speaking of these two sons, Simeon and Levi, he says they're brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. Oh, my soul, come not into their counsel. Oh, my spirit, be not joined to their company. For in their anger they slew men, and in their wantonness they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Now, dear friends, that reflects the feeling of Jacob, not merely at the time when the deed was perpetrated, but long years afterward when the time came to bless his family before he would depart. And I want you to note, dear friends, what Simeon and Levi were, and that neither Simeon nor Levi really had, so to speak, an inheritance in the land. What Simeon received was what was over of Judah. So he dwelt in among Judah with whatever Judah had left over. As far as Levi was concerned, we do know that he had no inheritance in the land. But notice the difference between the Levi that we find in the book of Genesis and the Levi that we find in the book of Exodus. In one we find Levi according to the flesh. In the other we find Levi after the grace of God has worked on him. While there were once instruments of cruelty in his habitation, in Exodus after God had worked upon him, he became the representative of God to the people, the blesser of the people instead of God, the one who by his own figurative death brought about atonement for his brethren. So you see how the grace of God can work. And when we think, when God has taken the foolish things of this world, he's taken So when you look at yourself, what do you find? Do you find sometimes when you've given somebody your advice and it is taken and something goes wrong, do you say, well, it serves them right, maybe the next time it'll... No. Well, you see, that isn't the spirit. But that is the spirit of Levi before. But the spirit of Levi is after is whatever God has to give. He cannot express himself. He is the representative of God the Father. Now, when it comes to Reuben, notice this. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the first fruits of my strength, preeminent in pride and preeminent in power. Unstable as water, you shall not have preeminence because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. You went up to my couch. Now the reason we're emphasizing these things here, friends, is because God is our Father. He loves us as his children. But what you and I do in the development of our character may not reveal itself in any of the judgments of God necessarily immediately. But when the time comes for reaping the blessing, where shall we stand? You were called to have the preeminence. You were the firstborns. But have you prostituted your covenant relationship? Have you brought it to the low point, humbling it, through doing not merely the will of God, but more often, your own will, your fleshly desire? Remember this, that whatever you do which is contrary to the will of God is fleshly. That's the reason God said, at least in one instance, that he would not always strive with man because of his fleshliness. He will strive with the Spirit. But you know, you can resist the Spirit. You can quench the Spirit. And if it has been quenched, then it is too late. Here is one who had the opportunity of having the preeminence among all his brethren, the firstborn. And yet he was disinherited. You know that danger exists for you and for me. A woman sometimes represents a covenant. Hagar represented a covenant. Rachel represented a covenant. Sarah represented a covenant. And we would suggest that Bilhah, Rachel's servant, also represented a covenant. And may we suggest it might represent the covenant that you have with God. The covenant to be dead to self, but alive to his will. Now, when you entered into that covenant with God, what did it imply? It implied that you had no right to the expression of your own desires, your own will. Whatever you did would have to be done according to the will of the Father. Now, if you didn't do that, to that extent, you were lowering the covenant, you were humbling it, you were bringing it down. Now, if in that covenant you made with God, it was absolute, all that I have, all that I am, or all that I ever expect to be, I've laid on the altar of sacrifice. And then you come along, and what do? You may put it this way, if God be willing, I'll do so and so. And then you go right ahead and you do as you please. And because God hasn't stopped you, you say, well, it must have been his will. Don't fool yourself that way. Sometimes God waits. And after you have developed the character that ties you into your Bible, that has made manifest the judgment of God. You have the preeminence, yes. You were called in the one hope of your calling. You're to be associated with Christ Jesus in the glory of the kingdom. But what have you done? Oh, you haven't sold your birthright for a mess of pottage. No, you didn't do it that way. But you did it just the same. You let go of what you had. For what? For the little pleasure the earth might be able to give you. The little pleasure that you might get out of this world. And by doing so, you lost what you had a perfect right to expect would be yours, because you were of the firstborns of God. That's why in the Revelation we find the expression, take heed, let no man take thy crown. The crown is yours. It's set apart for you. In fact, it has your name on it. But someone can take it, and a new name can be put on it. Your name is the name of Christ, and whoever bears it must be Christ-like. Now we find then, dear friends, that insofar as these children of Jacob were concerned, thus far we don't find the reflection of their father. No wonder sometimes, dear friends, we who call ourselves the sons of God, whether there is in us the reflection of our father's will, or whether there is for us the displeasure of God, so that someday he must disown us. For remember, it won't be for the last thing that you have done. It'll be for something that you have consistently done. And the adversary has this way about him. He's very subtle. He makes it appear as though it were good. He deceives, if it were possible, the very elect. But he's not going to deceive them. But they're not spared the deception because they are the very elect. But they are the very elect because they are not. Well, they're not the same, dear friend, with a difference. Now, the adversary would put darkness for light. And in some subtle little way, he puts before you a scheme or a proposition. Well, I don't see anything wrong in this. Well, that's the way you put it. And you know, as time goes on, you will see less wrong in it. And after a while, you see no wrong in it whatsoever. You see what's happened. There's a little secret fault. I wouldn't even call it a sin. But it's a fault, a secret fault. But it grows. It's just like a little bit of leaven that you put in the dough. Don't need much, but pretty soon the whole loaf is leavened. And so this little secret fault grows until it becomes presumptuous. In other words, it's a secret fault. You know it is a fault. You know that it isn't what God is pleased with. But this is the way that you reason about it. God knows my frame. He knows that I am but dust. Therefore, he's made provision for me. Christ is my advocate. And so, even if I do come short, now that's presumptuous. It is true that God has provided an advocate. But the advocate will not be our advocate under any conditions or circumstances. He is our advocate only so long as we will love righteousness and hate iniquity. You remember the battle that Israel fought with Amalek after they had been refreshed with the waters from the smitten rock? Moses was up in the hill on the mount. And he prayed for Israel, and so long as he kept his hands raised, Israel was victorious. But poor Moses' hands grew tired, and they dropped. And when they dropped, Israel lost. And so they had to do something about it. And Hur and Aaron were set up to hold the arms of Aaron up until victory was complete. Well, now, dear friends, we have one in the mount, too. We have been refreshed by the waters of life from the smitten rock. And then comes Amalek, the flesh, to battle with us. And what does he do? He's victor. We can never expect to overcome the flesh in our own strength. But we have one in the mount. Our Moses, our great deliverer, our intercessor, our advocate. But dear friends, he'll not advocate for you and for me. You say his arms will never fall. Of course they won't fall. But while they will fall, they nevertheless must be sustained else. So far as you are concerned, they will fall. He'll cease to be your advocate. And you've got to uphold both his arms. One is the love of righteousness, and the other is the hatred of iniquity. Now you see, dear friends, Reuben here, I don't know what he might have thought of. He might have thought, well, there's an excuse for me. Of course, I'm the head of house, and after all, this is merely a concubine. She's not my mother. And that's, of course, the way we figure. Oh, if it was my mother, I would never think of it. No, but she's someone else's mother. You see, that's where the selfishness of the flesh comes in. It looks out for itself, but has no thought or consideration for anyone else. Isn't it good that the law of the new creation is love? And isn't it good that the law for the world's mankind here, the millennial, will always be love? Do unto others as you'd have them do to you. What's that mean? That also means, dear friends, that you're not to do to others the things that you would not have them do to you. You see, there are the two sides. One is the love of righteousness, and the other is the hatred of iniquity. And to be perfectly rounded out, it isn't sufficient that you love righteousness, but you must also hate iniquity. And it was because of this that God's firstborn was given the inheritance. And the Apostle Paul tells us that he was anointed with the oil of gladness above his fellows. Why? Because he loved righteousness and hated iniquity. That was the reason. Now, are you represented in this firstborn of Jehovah? If you are, then, dear friends, it'll be only because, like Jesus, you love righteousness and hate iniquity. If, on the contrary, you do anything to compromise your covenant relationship with God, I don't care which covenant it is, it makes no difference. Whatever covenant that God is concerned in, if you humble it, bring it down to your level because you can't attain unto its level, you're going to reap the self-same reward that Reuben reaped. Well, some of you have heard me tell this before. We had a young lady in our office that was an inveterate smoker, and so one day I asked her, I said to her, Betty, do you suppose the Blessed Virgin would be smoking today if she were living? Well, she says, Mr. Fry, I think she would be perfectly modern. Now, you see what that means, dear friends. That means bringing her down to the level where she is instead of trying to aspire to the heights. That's what I mean by a compromise. In other words, instead of trying to live up to your covenant, you bring it down to your level and say, well, God knows, my friend, that I'm but dust and he doesn't expect too much from me. I can't do perfectly. And perhaps you find refuge, too, in the passages that Paul used. In my flesh there dwelleth no good thing. And when I would do good, evil is present with me. I can't do the things I want to do. I know what's right, but how to do it, I know not. Yes, Paul was honest when he said that, and it could be true of each and every one of us. But to use it as a cloak behind which we hide ourselves is entirely wrong, and that is a compromise, and that's humbling our covenant. And that's disregarding the will of God and his position. Had Reuben regarded the position of Jacob in his own household, he would never have done what he did. And it says, when this came to the knowledge of Jacob, and there's great pause, merely an indication of the unspeakable pain that it caused. And you can rest assured, dear friends, that if we may speak of God as having emotions, when you and I compromise our covenant, there is deep sorrow in the heart of God. Now, I say we're using words that people on our level can understand. But what that might mean for God, we cannot know, because the Bible merely brings God to the level of our understanding, telling us how he rejoices and tells us about the angels being glad at the conversion or the reclaiming of one, a sinner, from the corruption of his way. And so while Israel dwelt in the land, Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. And that's where it stops. Now there's going to be a change in the Bible narration. And all the sons of Jacob are listed. Then we'll have a list of all the sons of Ishmael, or rather Esau, and the Horites. And then they drop out from the picture, and we trace only the generations of Jacob. So he says, now the sons of Jacob were 12. The sons of Leah were Reuben, Jacob's firstborn. You see how emphasis is put there. Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel, Joseph, and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's maid, Dan, and Naphtali. Now notice it says, Rachel's maid. Now, I want you to look into this picture just a moment, dear friends. You know what Simeon and Levi did because of the humbling of their sister, Dinah. Now, suppose Dan and Naphtali
had done the very same thing
because of the humbling of their mother. Can you imagine what might have taken place in that household? Fortunately, this was the maid of Rachel, the most beloved of the wives of Jacob. And I have an idea. They were not so numerous and not so powerful as the sons of Leah. And then it goes on to say, the sons of Zilpah, Leah's maid, Gad and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Padan Aram. Now you notice it says these were born in Padan Aram. Now that's a generic expression. Actually, Benjamin was not born in Padan Aram. You remember, Benjamin was born
at Ephratah,
which is near the site of Bethlehem. And that is where Rachel died. But insofar as Isaac was concerned, and Jacob is going back to Hebron where his father Isaac is, insofar as Isaac was concerned, they were all born on foreign soil. And then it says, and Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre. You remember Mamre? That was the place where Abraham had lived. Evidently, Isaac had moved there to Mamre, the exalted place up in the mountains, not in the plains which lie below, but at Mamre, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years, and Isaac breathed his last. And he died and was gathered to his people, old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. In passing, I would like you to note that here it says Esau and Jacob buried him. But when it came to the burial of Abraham, it was Isaac and Ishmael. Just the transposition. You just think that over for a while. There is a transposition there. Then it says, these are the descendants of Esau, that is Edom. Esau took his wives from the Canaanites and so forth, and lists throughout the whole chapter there, and there isn't very, very much that we could say about that, except that at one place it says, these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the Israelites. That's the 31st verse in the 36th chapter. Now, dear friends, it is just this that causes the modernist, the agnostic, the higher critic to claim that Genesis was not written by Moses. For when Moses lived, there were no kings in Israel. And this says, these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the Israelites. The implication is that at the time this was written, there were kings who ruled over the Israelites. But I don't think we need to draw that conclusion. We do know that it speaks of Moses as having been a king and Jeshurun over Israel. It does specifically say that. But I don't think that Moses would have that in mind. What I think Moses had in mind was the fact that when the covenant was made with Abraham, when the promise was made, it says that kings would come out of his loins. These kings had not yet come. Prophetically, it was looking forward to the time when there would be kings. Well, the kings are Christ and his church. Because he will cause us to be kings and priests of God, won't he? This is the seed of Abraham, and this would be the fulfillment of the promise. But in a lesser sense, we find that there were kings of Israel, but surely not at this particular time. However, we don't need to concern ourselves too much then with this 36th chapter, because it merely deals with the generations of Esau and the generations of the Horites, who of course were more or less vanquished by Esau, and oftentimes they were as one people. So we'll commence with the 37th chapter. Jacob dwelt in the land of his father, sojournings, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a lad with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought an ill report of them to their father. Now look, dear friends, in many instances where God uses an ancient to be a type of the Christ, he more often than not has been a shepherd. Moses was a shepherd. Joseph was a shepherd. And we find that David was a shepherd. No doubt about that. And those whom God loves and will exalt, he always gives a little training with the sheep of God. Now with goats, but with sheep. And so he was a shepherd lad, and he was out in the field. He was only 17 years old, and he was with his stepbrothers out in the field. He was the youngest of them all. Benjamin was a younger son, but he was still not out in the field. He was too young at this time. So it says that Joseph brought an ill report of them to their father, who happened to be his own father. Now you see, dear friends, you might say, well, he was a tattletale. He should never have said anything about it. But you see, he was put in that position by his father. And so he came, and when he saw that things weren't exactly as his father would have them, he told his father about it. And you know, that would just make them love him so much more. You can well imagine. You know what they call you today for doing that. You just mind your own business, they'll tell you. But there are some things where God is concerned where you've got to be very, very careful. And you don't need to go and tell God about it. But you can tell those who may be falling short of the glory of God in their lives about it. But it says here, after tells us that he brought this evil report concerning them, now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a long robe with sleeves, or the robe of many colors. Now, there is something of unwisdom in this, insofar as Jacob is concerned, where you have children more than one. You must never play one a favorite. Because if you do, the others will be sensitive to it. And sooner or later, there is strife, jealousy, hatred, and one never knows. And he that hates his brother has the spirit of a murderer. We'll see how true this was in the family of Jacob. Heir of the promise, brethren, that didn't love one another. But at any rate, he loved him and he called him the son of his old age. Now, you know, dear friends, he had a younger son than this by far, who was more the son of his old age than Joseph could have been. So you see, we're dealing with generalities. He was the son of his old age only because of the fact that he was so dear to the heart of his father. The youngest one was practically an infant. But here was one son that evidently loved his father, and he, of all of them, then becomes typical of the heir of the promise. He becomes a type of the Christ. And the pictures that we shall be able to enjoy from the life of Joseph will be beautiful only because of the fact that they reflect the life and the experiences of Christ. But they will be beneficial to you and to me because we are identified with that Joseph. We are a part of that antitypical Joseph. We are part of him who will be the blesser, not only of his own brethren, but all those represented in Egypt, the rest of the world, mankind. Now Israel loved him, and this is what he did. He made him a special coat. Now it says a coat of extremes. That may refer to its length. Luther believed it referred to the color. He translated from the Septuagint. And the result is that many of the translators have followed him and called it a robe of many colors. Perhaps that thought is included. We can't be too sure, but we're going to speak of it as the coat of many colors. And as such, it was a robe of distinction. Most of the shepherds, you will recall, dear friends, and if you don't recall, you probably use common sense and say, well, if they've got to do a lot of climbing and going through forts, through bodies of water to get to the other side, their garments would only come down probably to their knees. But this was an extremely long garment. And their garments, the shepherds, their garments wouldn't have sleeves. They would be sleeveless. But his had sleeves. And as you could see, it looked like a Roman toga. It looked as though he was arrayed and he was an aristocrat among his brethren. Now you can see when a father does a thing like that, it will have the tendency to set the brethren at odds with him. But there is another angle. Hasn't the father a right to do according as he sees circumcision. And there's a lesson for you and for me again. If in the providences of God, he finds one or another that he blesses particularly in some special way in which he does not bless you, it may be that you are to recognize that you haven't developed the character that would warrant God honoring you in that way. Oh, you say, I'd like to know as much about the truth as brother or sister so-and-so. Of course you'd like to. But would you work for it the way they work for it? No, I don't have the time. Well, they don't either. Well, how do they do it? Well, they just have to make the time. Do you suppose that pleases God? It certainly does. You know what you and I sometimes do? We have time. What do we do with it? Make ourselves comfortable. Anybody else? Oh, well, yes, but we're first. And you see, that is the reason that God oftentimes withholds from you and from me what he will give to another. This coat of many colors was what causes brethren to become jealous. And if you become jealous or envious of someone that God has honored, then look out, because you already have the spirit of a murderer. You have the spirit of Joseph's brethren. But you see, Joseph was a young lad. He was just a boy, 17 years old. And he was a dreamer. I heard of a case only a short time ago. A sister in the truth was telling us about her brother. A little child was born. It didn't live, I guess, more than a day. It died. And he looked at the stars and the horoscope. He said, well, it would have been a dreamer anyway. It's just as well dead as living. You see? He didn't want a dreamer. Oh, dear friends, there are dreamers and dreamers. Joseph was a dreamer, but the dreams that he had weren't the result of any indigestion. That's the difference. The dreams that he had, I would say, were God-inspired. You have dreams too, don't you? Oh, yes. Someday, you know, I'm laying up a little aside every year, and probably when I get to be 50 or 60 years old, I'm just going to relax. I'll have Social Security at 65 and all of that. You're dreaming, of course. But let me tell you that that dream is the result of your improperly digesting the Word of God. That's a dream which comes from your indigestion. It's not God-inspired. The dream which God inspires is the one which will not lay up the treasure on the earth, but will lay it up in heaven. Oh, Brother Five, it's easy enough for you to talk. You're an old man now. Is that so? Oh, but dear friends, it wouldn't make any difference what your age. You've got to see to it, if you dream, that you dream the dreams which God inspires. And he inspires them from his word. But you know, if you take the word of God, you don't chew it, and you don't masticate it, you don't digest it. And when you're dreaming, you're going to have some weird dreams. Did you ever have a weird dream? Ever find yourself jumping and kicking and running and everything and wake up all in a sweat? I don't think that's the way that
Joseph
woke up from his dream. Some dreams are just dreams. Some dreams are the sternest realities. And so we find then that he was a dreamer. And in the fifth verse it says, now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they only hated him the more. And here's another lesson for you, dear guys. We can get so happy. When you have the little secret that God reveals to you, and sometimes he does, you've got to keep the secret to yourself. Because sometimes if you let that secret out, you'll only make the person that you're telling it to jealous of you. Brother Russell, in an article treating on Joseph, mentions this fact, that he should have kept it a secret. It would have been better for him at this time not to tell his dream. But you see, he was only a lad, shall I say, ever pheasant, just bubbling up. He had this dream, and so what does he do? He tells his brothers, and they only hated him the more. Now, he was hated already because his father had honored him. Now, they hated him still more for the dream he had, and not merely for the fact that he had the dream, but because he told them the dream. Now, if he hadn't told them the dream, they wouldn't have hated him just this much, but a little less, see? So it behooves us, dear friends, not always to tell all that we know. And when you have something to say, you want to make sure that it's good. So it says here, he said to them, hear this dream which I have dreamed. Can't you imagine? Joseph runneth around him. He says, say, I had a dream last night. Here, listen to this. We were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered round it and bowed down to my sheaf. That was something that just added more fire to the flame. More fuel, at least. And they loved him all the more. Or, no, just in reverse. They loved him the less. They hated him more for it. In other words, here was the sheaf. And I tell you, dear friends, he was the one that was gathering the sheaf later on in Egypt, wasn't he? Yes, he did just that. He did it for Pharaoh. And then it says, his brother said to him, are you indeed to reign over us? See how jealousy and envy manifest itself. Or are you indeed to have dominion over us? So they hated him yet more for his dreams and for his words. You see, dear friends, what we said before, not only for having the dream, but for having told them. Now, if you didn't tell me, I wouldn't be jealous. But the fact that you told me, now I'm jealous. Then he dreamed another dream, and he told it to his brothers and said, behold, I have dreamed another dream, and behold, the sun, the moon, the 11 stars were bowing down. Notice 11 stars. It's bad enough that he just said stars, but when he said 11 stars, 11, let's see. They're just 11 of us without him. Yes, you see, they began to see just exactly what the import of it was. And so, but when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream which you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you? And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the same in his mind. That's in his heart. Now, you will note then, dear friends, that when Jacob had told this story about the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowing down, as it were, before him, that his brethren, Joseph, that they became jealous of him. And the jealousy, of course, was of the kind that had already had an early start. And you know, you don't have to take care of weeds. You never need to cultivate them. You never need to sprinkle or water them. They just grow. And so it is with envy, hatred, malice, and strife. They're weeds. They don't need cultivation. They'll grow without a bit of attention. You take the cultivated plant and you just let it do without water for a while and begin to droop and it'll die. But look how long a weed will stand and grow and grow and grow without any water. And while this needed no cultivation, it got a little extra watering, this envy and strife, when Joseph told his dream to them. But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves down before you?" Now notice this says, your mother. His mother was dead. Rachel had died. So what is the significance? The significance is still the same. In other words, it meant all the members of his household. Now that Rachel was dead, perhaps Leah, or maybe Bilhah, might have acted as his mother. But it makes no difference which it was. The indication was that someday they would all be called upon to recognize Joseph. It merely made his brethren jealous. The father rebuked him for it because he couldn't see that he too would have to bow down. But he tested in his own mind, in his heart, as the mother of Jesus did. She stored it up in her heart, and there was a reason for this. Now as his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem, you notice, dear friends, that the flock was down in Shechem. And you'd think that after they had done what they did down there in Shechem, that they would be afraid to go there again. But it seems that the fear of God were upon all the people that they came in contact with, and furthermore, Jacob had bought a piece of land down there that was still his. And so they were supposed to be there attending to the sheep. They were, their flocks were so great that they needed wide pasturage. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he said, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word again." So he went. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields, and the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I'm seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, I pray you, where they are pasturing the flock." And the man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at the Dothan. That's where we're going to stop today, dear friends. I think from this point on, this was just a little gap in there, but from this point on, where we trace the life of Joseph, and gradually we'll come into the experiences of the nation of Israel and their wilderness wanderings. And I think that is one of the most fruitful, one of the most blessed portions of God's Word, because in it we find reflected the will of God concerning His own, and what was recorded of them was written for our admonition. In other words, the mere fact that it is a story, or seems to be a story, just folklore, it isn't. It's more than that. It was written by the hand of God for the children that had not yet been born, but the children whom He will teach to become imitators of His own glorious character. May God bless them.